I'd like to welcome you to today's lecture, which is sponsored by the Department of International Relations. I fear we'll have a group of PhD students troop in who Amelia kindly agreed to speak with over lunch and who are perhaps enjoying their dessert while we ran over here in advance. So don't mind them as they troop in. It's a great pleasure to introduce Amelia Kurki, who's here today to speak to us about her new cutting-edge research, international relations in a cosmological context. She says that this is a work very much in progress, and she's really keen to engage with us in terms of constructive criticism and response to work that is a new kind of frontier off there in the universe. And perhaps it's quite interesting to see this development in her work, given her past work, which combines sort of stratospheric heights of IR theory, and then some very interesting empirical work on the ground in the dark corridors of policymaking in Brussels and elsewhere. She's the author, as many of you know, of Causation, International Relations, Reclaiming Causal Analysis, published by Cambridge University Press in 2008, and then Democratic Futures, Revisioning Democracy Promotion, published in 2012 by Routledge. So she's worked on a wide range of very different kinds of topics at very different kinds of vantage points, and edits the journal International Relations and is a member of the editorial board of the Review of International Studies. And, of course, she's a professor in international relations theory at Aberystwyth University. So it gives me great pleasure, without further ado, to leave you to Amelia.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I shall stand up. I shall stand up and see how we do. I have a little presentation just because when speaking about matters cosmological, you've got to have a few pictures, I find. And so hence, I will have a little bit of a PowerPoint. Not that there's too much content on that. Thanks very much for being here, but also thank you for inviting me, and also thanks for the toleration to allow me to speak on this this relational cosmology project. It's something that is very close to my heart at the moment, partly because I've been on sabbatical for the last 6 months working on it, and I have a draft of the book, but it's very much evolving as things go. So what I'd like to do today is present kind of the general gist of the ideas, see how that goes down, and then I'd be very welcome indeed of all kinds of criticism, comments, help, and so on. Certainly in the IR aspects, because the IR aspect is the least worked on bit at the moment. So let's see if you could help me there in various kinds of ways. So the book that I'm working on is a book that is trying to look at the implications of scientific cosmology for thinking about international relations or social theorizing more generally. IR kind of follows from the some moves that I'm trying to develop in relation to social theory. And it's basically a book that comes out from a personal circumstance of various kinds. We actually talked about some of these already over lunch. As some of you might know, I've been working on various kind of theoretical things for some years to do with democracy and to do with kind of different conceptions of democracy and the local ownership by various groups of populations of the concept of democracy. As part of this, I was working on a research bit on situated knowledges and the thinking through local ownership in democracy promotion through the concept of situated knowledge. As I was doing that work for my work, I've also been doing some private work for the Open University as an astrophysics, aspiring astrophysics undergraduate student, not always a very successful one. But what was striking a couple of years ago, and it coincided with the burnout, I must admit, the two kind of strands of thinking from the social sciences, social theory, some of the practical interest in democracy, coming together with reading and thinking on cosmology and scientific cosmology particularly. And the reason I became interested in exploring this further was that actually thinking about scientific cosmology helps me think through some of the social theoretical puzzles about relationality, situated knowledge, and what that means. And so out of those initial kind of ideas has come this rather, some say, crazy book. For me, it's not a crazy book, but it's actually it has a very specific point to make. But what it's trying to do is put together scientific cosmology, some social theoretical debates about relationality and relationalism, with also some thoughts about international relations, how we might orient to the subject of international relations somewhat differently from these avenues. So what I was going to do in this talk, and I will be reminded when I go over, and I hope I don't go over too much, is to do three things. One, I want to briefly to speak about scientific cosmology and what that is, as opposed to social cosmology or social understandings about the cosmos and so on. I then want to talk a little bit about relational cosmology. When I talk about international relations and cosmological context, I'm actually talking about this particular approach to cosmology called relational cosmology, which is a physics set of ideas, but it has very interesting consequences as well as dialogues already with the social sciences. So I'll talk a little bit about what the core moves of relational cosmology are. And then I want to address in the final section what kind of orientations, at least in my head, thinking through international relations from this relational cosmology perspective actually gives us. And for me, there's three sets of moves that I'm working on. One on knowledge and thinking about situated knowledge as something a little bit different from our classical social theoretical conceptions of situated knowledge. But also want to talk about some of the arguments that I'm developing at the moment on the kind of ontology that we might see in international relations if we look at it from the point of view of relational cosmology rather than from kind of more classical social theoretical kinds of settings. There's all kinds of ethical implications that also come out from some of these arguments, but they are a little bit undeveloped at the moment. So let's see. Probably won't have time to even address them, but we might throw them out at the end there. So that's the plan of action today. So what is scientific cosmology? Well, basically, scientific cosmology is a scientific study of the universe, the cosmos. In its macro scales, so the most macro scales that there are. Origins of the universe, the structure of the universe, the structure of various components that make the universe, historical evolution of the universe, and so on. Now, study of the macro scale of the universe, of course, is tied up with study of the micro scale, partly because one of the key scientific findings of scientific cosmology has been that the micro quantum mechanical things are fundamentally interlinked with the macro, the structure of the macro. So in scientific cosmology, two things kind of come together. Now, the key issue that always arises, and arises also centrally for me, is what's the difference between a scientific cosmology as opposed to just a cosmology, a religious cosmology, a common sense cosmology, a socially inherited cosmological set of beliefs, and so on. Well, I come from a scientific realist background, and there is something I think we can turn to here when we think about cosmology in relation to scientific realism. One of the key contentions that arises from a scientific realist reading of scientific cosmology is quite simply the claim that there's a universe out there that is recalcitrant to our beliefs about it, but a scientific cosmology is trying to test our beliefs, systematically test our beliefs, against the thing that is actually out there. Whether the thing is out there separately from us and so on, that's a different matter. We'll come to that, actually. But the key point of scientific cosmology from this perspective, and most scientific cosmologists themselves are realist, philosophically realist about what it is that they do, not all of them, but most of them. The key point to note, then, is that scientific cosmology is not just a study of what social beings, what people think about the cosmos. Of course, all scientific cosmologists are also people, they would probably say. And as such, their socially inherited assumptions, our conceptual frameworks, our ways of thinking about the cosmos, of course they have an implication for how they write and how they think about the cosmos. But it's not the case that scientific cosmology is simply reducible to our beliefs about the cosmos. There's a difference between a religious cosmology that relies on faith, essentially, common sense belief about cosmology, our kind of everyday assumptions about the universe and us and the planet and so on, and a scientific cosmology that is explicitly trying to test particular sets of theories and hypotheses about the universe against the universe, if you allow that formulation. So why should we care about this scientific cosmology? Well, one of the interesting things in the first place to just note about scientific cosmology is that we've learned a hell of a lot about it in the last 100 years, in the last 50 years, in the last 20 years or so. If you think about the origins of IR and a lot of social theory too, I mean, we're coming up to our centenary in Everest, which we said, origins of IR and Everest 100 years ago or so. 100 years ago or so, when you think about cosmology, we had no conception whatsoever of a lot of the key things. So we had no idea if there was anything outside of the galaxy that we're in. We had no idea of star formation of elements within stars, let alone about the origins of life in particular sets of context, let alone about the Big Bang, so-called Big Bang, if you want to call it. And since then, lots and lots of advances have been made in scientific cosmology. In many ways, people say it is one of the sciences where some of the biggest achievements, if you like, in knowledge have been made, partly due to new kinds of technologies, for example, radio astronomy. And the reason to be interested about this is that there is a fundamental link between how we think about the cosmos and how we think about social and political systems. And this is one of the key points that relational cosmologists, but also historians of scientific cosmology, regularly and importantly make. How we think about the structure of the cosmos, structure of the universe, has a direct link to how we think about society, social systems. So classic example, if you think about Newtonian cosmology and Newtonian conceptions of the universe, and you compare that to a kind of liberal understanding of society, and you compare the ideas of the kind of the atoms moving around in accordance with particular sets of laws, potentially against what you might call an inanimate background, the similarities and the, in direct terms, sense almost, the legacies of particular conceptual systems travel across the different sciences. And this, in essence, is why relational cosmologists, but also some other sets of cosmologists, think it's fundamentally important for us in the social sciences, political sciences, international relations also, to think about how it is that our conceptual universes, if you like, are structured. What kind of cosmologies, what kind of conceptual systems underpin them? Are there Newtonian assumptions about things, backgrounds, and so on in how we think? Are there particular conceptions of relationalities, processing, and so on, traveling across these sciences? In IR, there's been quite a lot of interesting work on this recently. I mean, Will Bain's book, some of you might know, is fundamentally interesting in this regard. It talks about the theological origins of international relations thinking. But of course, for Will Bain, theology is actually cosmology, because theological conceptions were tied up fundamentally with particular cosmological systems. Audra Mitchell's work also on this recently, I think, is very interesting. She looks at the ways in which conceptions of intervention are tied up with particular secular, theological secular conceptions of humans being in control of their environment, as if somehow replaying a kind of God's children kind of scenario. So the basic point then is that relational cosmology is interesting because, well, scientific cosmology is interesting because lots of advances have been made in that field, but also directly those findings and advances in relational cosmology are not irrelevant to us. And the reason they're not irrelevant to us is because our conceptual systems are tied up in intricate ways with other kinds of sets of assumptions that we make about nature and the universe and so on. So what I'm trying to do with the book then is trying to figure out what are some of these links, what some of these links are. And one of the interesting things for me has been that some of the puzzles I've had about social theoretical questions, I think I mentioned this before, kind of are revisited in an interesting and fruitful way, actually, from this relational cosmology and the perspective that it gives you. So that's the general idea. So, of course, there are multiple sets of theoretical lines of thought when it comes to scientific cosmology. In the work that I've been playing with, I've been playing with the idea of relational cosmology, which is a particular orientation to scientific cosmology. Its basic principles are shared across the multiple sets of paradigms, if you like, in scientific cosmology. So some of the ideas of the standard model, some of the ideas of inflationary multiverse theories especially, are shared with relational cosmology. That said, relational cosmology is a particular critique that emanates from within physics, and particularly a different reading of quantum mechanics, of some of the more dominant or standard ways of thinking about scientific cosmology. Specifically, relational cosmology takes on string theory and multiverse imaginations of the cosmos. And there are particular reasons to that which we'll come to. A lot of them are tied up with their different conception of mathematics and the way in which we come to think about laws and mathematics. But in essence, relational cosmology, it's developed by various sets of people. Lee Smolin is one person I particularly like, partly because he has not only is he a physicist working on quantum loop gravity, which is this particular approach to quantum theory that relational cosmology arises from, but also he's particularly keenly interested in how those ideas travel across and over into social sciences and political sciences also. So one of the key arguments, and of course I can't go through all the key arguments and so on, but the key arguments I'd like to set out of relational cosmology are just threefold, really. The key point that relational cosmology makes is this notion of relationality. Essentially, scientific cosmologists that come from the relational cosmology background, the key claim is that there's something fundamentally wrong with the way in which physicists come at the subject of cosmology. Their point is that there's a legacy, if you like certain remnants of Newtonian thinking that are still fundamentally structuring the way in which physicists come to cosmology. Specifically, the problem is the assumptions about things and backgrounds, or what they call background dependence. Newtonian cosmology, and Smolin and others explain this far better, but this is my summary of what they argue. Newtonian cosmology starts from the perspective that you have an absolute space and time. You have a background against which things move. The movement of those bodies and other things in it can be tracked on the basis of particular sets of regularities, but also that we can derive certain mathematical laws that describe the movement of those bodies. If we take that to be the basic starting point of kind of Newtonian cosmology, the key point that relational cosmologists make is that that is not a viable way in which we can think about the cosmos or the universe. And the reason that is quite simply, it arises from their basic starting point, which is the whole universe is the whole universe. it ties together as the universe. So causal loops, if you like, in the universe tie in within the universe. So as such, there's nothing in the universe that is a background. And the key point of especially quantum loop gravity, which is the quantum mechanical approach that this whole approach is based on, it argues that space itself is a relational thing. It's something that arises out of what they call spin networks, and this is where the limits of my mathematics are, so I really come to their limit. But the basic argument is that space is not a background. It cannot be theorized as a background. Time also is not a background of any kind. They emerge out of the relations within the universe as it unfolds. And as such, nothing in the universe is really a thing moving against backgrounds. Everything in the universe is relationally related and unfolding in relations to other sets of relations. And so the key starting point is that, of course, in our language and in our everyday practice and so on, it's practical to think about things in terms of things and backgrounds. But the basic point is that if we start to buy into the idea that this is actually the case, we're fundamentally misunderstanding the nature of the thing we're in. We're also, as such, misunderstanding how we're in it, how we are relational processes within the universe itself. So a key point of relational cosmology is to say, on the basis of relativity theories and quantum loop gravity theories, that what we have to understand about the universe is that it's a relational unfolding, sets of relations. And primary are things, are not things, but relations. Things are approximations, conceptual approximations that we give to relations unfolding that we observe from our particular perspectives. Some of you, I mean, Chris might have been in some of these debates with Colin White. Colin White always argues, how can you have relations without things? The whole key point of relational cosmology exactly is to say, you can't have things without relations, actually. So as such, you flip the whole thing the other way around from the usual kind of starting point. But the reason that this is vaguely interesting is also because they then argue certain really important things about how we know about the universe and our place in it. Well, if we're in a relational universe, we're always situated knowers within the universe. This is fundamentally important for them because one of the key sets of assumptions in physical theories of the cosmos is that we can somehow observe the universe out there and we're out here. The key point of relational cosmology is to say that you never observe in the universe from the outside. You can never try to model the universe from the outside. You can never try to, really, if you do cosmology properly, look at parts of the universe in isolation of the entire thing itself, because it's a relational unfolding thing. So the challenge for cosmologists, then, is to think through what that means. And basically, Lee Smolin's work, especially, is centrally tied up with this notion. What does physics look like if we do physics from the point of view of us being relationally related processes in a relationally unfolding universe? If we can't get ever outside of the relations that we're in, then every single piece of knowledge about the physics is also tied up with and comes out of the relations that we're in ourselves. This has then consequences for arguments about laws and mathematics and history, certainly. Because one of the key things that relational cosmologists argue is that there's no such thing as natural laws. As such, if we think that laws are such things that sit there, out there, as some sort of background according to which things move. In many ways, their point is to say, if we use the word laws, fine, but laws are essentially descriptions of certain sets of processes that look like laws from where we are in our situated context in the universe. But they are not laws in the sense that they're somehow outside the universe. They're not given by God, by some outside influence. They're not somehow put outside the universe to govern it. They are part of the unfolding of the thing itself, including the fine-tuning of the constants and so on, proton mass and so on and la la la. They are relational properties that unfold from the relational unfolding of the universe. They're not kind of out there, and we can't get at them as if the laws were somehow out there, or that we somehow were outside the universe observing and saying those are the laws of the universe of that place down there. The reason this is a little bit significant also for us is precisely because of the critique of maths and the ways of knowing that you should deploy in the physical sciences. The key point of Lee Smolin, The Life of the Cosmos especially, is to argue that in order to access the universe, we need historical knowledge of its evolution. We don't need mathematics. Mathematics is a useful tool, but in a later book just that came out this year, it's called, a book called Single Universe, Roberto Mangabeira Unger and Lee Smolin together argue that maths has a kind of selective practicality. It's a selective set of tools that evolutionarily related beings like us have invented to capture certain aspects of the universe. But there is no such thing as a kind of mathematical structure to the universe that is somehow outside the universe that we can somehow capture from the outside. And what we need to realize then is maths is just one particular tool through which we try to capture certain aspects of the unfolding of the relations in the universe. But fundamentally, what we need to understand is why do we have the particular laws? Why do particular mathematical equations apply in particular cases? Well, that we can only understand by doing history of the evolution of the universe, not synchronic modeling of the universe in particular regions of the cosmos at particular times, but explanations of the history of the tuning of our natural laws, including also to particular sets of parameters. In there's different types of relational cosmology here, and they have slightly disagreeing views about how to explain the history of the Big Bang and so on. But their key point is that those are the questions you need to ask. How is it that the Big Bang comes out with the particular kind of consciousness? Not to stop the story where the standard model, some people say, stops the story. Trace it back to the Big Bang, and then you say that's the when the universe was originated. But that tells us nothing about the problem. It just states the problem. Why are the properties of the Big Bang as they are? What is the cause of those particular sets of properties? And there's a couple of different ways in which you can think about it. Ekpyretic model essentially argues that it's the collisions of certain brains, the five-dimensional brains, that creates a particular kind of power source, if you like, for the Big Bang, but also creates a kind of evolution of the variants, the variables or constants from the setting from within it arises. The Lee Smolin's model is basically reliant on the idea of on black holes, and as black holes burst into, well, it's quite difficult to explain. The best way to describe it is that the best way in which we can understand our own universe is to think about it as one universe in a kind of a big universe within which black holes form themselves often. If we have a fitness landscape within which black holes form themselves often, we get the kind of constants that we have in this particular universe. The whole point here, though, is it's a critique of multiverse models in the classical senses, because the key idea that he tries to develop is that we have to historically trace how it is that those black hole-producing properties in the universe emerge, rather than to say, there's a multiverse. We're just in one out here, and there's something out there, somehow outside of our universe. There's nothing outside of our universe. We're in it, and we're off it, and we're historically kind of coming out of it. And that's what he's trying to develop, which is what's called an evolutionary account of the Big Bang. So those are basically the key moves of relational cosmology. As you can probably tell, there's quite a deep critique of theology and theological conceptions within it. In fact, relational cosmology, even though you could say, and will say says to me all the time, relational cosmology also comes potentially from a particular kind of theological reading about relationality and so on. Still, at the heart of what Lee Smolin especially writes is a kind of critique of the legacy of theological assumptions about the cosmos embedded into physics thinking. So his account of the crisis of physics is relying on basically on the argument that in physics, even though we know that we have moved far, far away from the account that, you know, God created us in a special planet over here, la la la, in fact, our ways of thinking still go back to that. That we have laws that were set by God somehow outside there that we as rational beings can somehow capture because we have some privileged access to it. Well, in a relational cosmology universe, you're just not in that situation where you have that special privileged background or relationship to the background. And out of it comes quite a deep kind of critique of theological thinking. I'm yet to work out what Will's point, what the consequences of Will's point is, of the theological underpinnings of the relational cosmology itself. He's probably very right that there are such also there. How am I doing for time?
Good, pretty much another 15 minutes.
15 minutes, okay, that's good. So the interest for me then has been, and this really started with an interest in situated knowledge, but there are three moves that I'm trying to work through in the book. So what are the implications of thinking about knowledge and generation of knowledge from the point of view of relational cosmology? What are the implications of thinking about ontology or the kinds of things that should concern international relations? The kinds of things that we should look at, things, see? The language is almost impossible to avoid. And then what are the ethical consequences of looking at knowledge and ontology, perhaps in somewhat different kinds of ways? The first move, some of you have heard already, probably a couple of times, and it was actually published in, I presented it first in the Millennium Conference two years ago, and Cora and others, thankfully, published the piece. But the first move is really a move about this situated knowledge, but stretching situated knowledge. One of the key starting points of relational cosmology is to force us to think about this problem that Terry Rudolph calls monkey realism. If we're in a relational universe, and we are social theorists and so on, we quite understand this rather well. The point of relational cosmology is that physicists do not so well understand this point, but social theorists do. The key point for us is, if we're in a relational universe and we come out from a particular set of relations within that thing, how is it that we gain knowledge about the thing that we're in? Now, because of the theological legacies, Lee Smolin and others would suggest that we think that we have kind of access to the universe somehow, but also not just that, that we have access to ourselves. We particularly have access to ourselves because we're human. So in many ways, you could say that's the basic principle of this human and social sciences. We can know something about the humans because we're human. We can access their brains and understand what's going on in their brains because we're human. But as some of these relational cosmologists, but also some other social theorists have argued, the problem is that because we're human, we have particularly a lot of problems in trying to access the thing called the human. And that's because our assumptions about us are fundamentally embedded in the very societies that we come from, the very conceptual systems that we come from. This is the basic problem of post-positivism and interpretive social sciences and so on. And there's various ways in which you can kind of try to solve the problem, and one of the key starting points for a lot of post-positivism of critical realist type and so on also has been this idea of situating knowledge. So we situate our knowledge in the social context from within which we arise for. We get a better understanding of why it is that we think about the nature of the world and the nature of the problems in particular kinds of ways, and if we do so, we can somehow gain a better, more objective, or as Sandra Harding argues, strong objective knowledge. Better knowledge because we're actually understanding, thinking about the social context within which our knowledge arises, the kind of conceptual limitations, if you like, that we work with. But the interesting thing for the relational cosmologist is that the argument would be quite different. The argument would be that instead of situating ourselves simply in relations, one of the things we have to do if we want to think scientifically about the nature of the problem is to try to pull ourselves out, stretch ourselves out from the very conceptions of the world that we work with. So instead of kind of glorifying situated knowledge, our knowledge about the world from a very particular context, what we need to do is kind of try to develop different conceptual categories, ways of thinking about the world, to, in a sense, queer our monkey realistic knowledge. I haven't really explained this monkey realism yet. The reason that's actually not a monkey, it's an ape. So it's a flippant thing. The key point of monkey realism, let me just briefly explain this. It comes from Terry Rudolph's work, where basically he just says, as monkeys, we kind of tend to think that, you know, this is a bottle and it's there. And if all of a sudden the bottle isn't there, then we tend to think that someone kind of stole the bottle or someone took it or threw it away or something on those lines. The basic point about quantum mechanics and also some of the relativity theories and so on is that we actually have ways of understanding why it might not be there, even though we expect it to be there. So there's a certain sense of expectations we have about the world because of the kind of evolutionary beings that we are. There's some cognitive capacities that we have because of the kind of evolutionary context we come from, the kinds of things that we've had to do in order to eat, in order to sleep, in order to evolve, and so on. So our ways of thinking about the world are always necessarily monkey realistic. They're realistic to the kind of cognitive capacities and conceptual systems we have about the world. But that does not mean that monkey realism has anything to do with philosophical realism, or that it has anything directly to do with what the reality is like. So our capacity to understand reality is fundamentally limited by our particular relational properties that are given rise to by the particular relationalities that we happen to be in the universe. So hence, yeah, monkey realisms. And the problem of situated knowledge and thinking about stretching situated knowledge is how do you deal with that problem? Well, for relational cosmology, the answer in a sense is that you're never going to deal with the problem fully, because we're always going to be, you know, monkeys with limited sets of knowledge. But one of the key things that we must do is try to stretch ourselves conceptually out from the ways in which we think. So if you think about, you know, space-time, if you think about field theories and so on, they're all attempts by physicists to try to take language that we've got, monkey concepts, and try to queer them, make them mean different things in order to capture something about the world that our brains are almost incapable of kind of understanding. But the challenge of science here is not to describe or to situate per se, it's to stretch away from the situated knowledges that we have of the world. And the idea I've been playing with in the book and in the Stretching Situated Knowledge article is exactly the same thing for kind of social sciences too. There are various critiques of the social and so on, Latourians and others, that might even agree with some of those points. The challenge, in a sense, for knowing is not necessarily to situate, but rather to try to stretch away, to queer our language, to break apart what seems like a sensible way of describing the world. The consequence of this is, for those of you that know some of my work from before, is that I used to be quite an ardent critical realist or something on those lines, and I always have been a bit of a Marxist and so on. But the consequences of this kind of move are really foundationally kind of undermining, I think, in many ways. Not foundationally, not completely undermining, but at least partially undermining of those kinds of arguments. They actually point to much closer to something like almost post-structuralist arguments or Adornoian kind of arguments about how we might gain knowledge. So that's one of the moves I try to work with in the book. The other same moves revolve around these just ponderings around ontology and what it is that matters in the study of international relations. And the starting point I should say on this is quite simply this. When we think about cosmology and cosmologists, Brian Cox, Carl Sagan, and so on, we tend to think that to think about the world and us in it somehow from a cosmological context means that we kind of pull ourselves out from the planet and we look at it from up high and we say, right, we have problems here, we must come together, hold hands, and perhaps try to come up with different ways of governing ourselves. Heikki Patomäki has actually developed some such ideas about global identity and reshaping global identity and so on from kind of a different perspective on the world from a cosmological context. Brian Cox himself explicitly argues in his Human Universe stuff that that's exactly what we need to do, that we need to rethink our humanity and especially our relations to each other, the pettiness of our religious and national conflicts and so on, if you look at things from a cosmological context. Well, one of the key things that I'd like to argue is that one of the striking things about that way of coming at cosmology and how it matters is that it's exactly reproducing, in some senses, it seems to me, the kind of logic of pulling out, looking at things from the outside, coming back into it, and then redoing things like the fallen children of God on the planet. And so one of the things I've been playing with is not so much this image of the world, the kind of gold cosmos where we humans, as the special, rational, most evolved beings, are somehow responsible for correcting the fallen nature of man and its treatment of the world, instead of looking at things like that, I'm playing more with the looking at things like that, what Dorian Sagan might call the ways in which we are and we come messily from a motley of processes in what we are. So one of the things I'm trying to argue with this particular chapter in the book is that instead of kind of lifting our views on the basis of a cosmological understanding of the world, what we need to do is kind of ground it down into the relations that we're off and that we're in, which actually result in somewhat different moves from the glorification, if you like, of the human capacities to kind of correct themselves and do things different and be the kind of children of God, if you will, secular children, of course, of God and so on. And actually it results in this very messy picture of what it means to think about what matters when you think about humans, social relations, and the environment that we're in. And this is where I've been led by this relational cosmology and thinking about it much more to humanist sets of arguments. There are various post-humanist writers already in international relations, and I think it's the right kind of relationality, the right kind of relational thinking to go down on the basis of a cosmological, or at least a relational cosmological understanding of the world. And it's quite a, for me, just personally, a little bit worrying, partly because I've always been a very ardent humanist, I think, and so on. But there is a kind of a withering away of the humanism of a kind that emerges, at least for me, from trying to think about ontology through a relational cosmology. How to without taking too long. Let's put it this way. If you think about international relations, if you think about relationalities and relational thinking in international relations, one way to look at it would be to say that in more classical paradigms of international relations, there is perhaps, I would suggest, a kind of a Newtonian understanding of how things work. It's things like the states, and they interact in a kind of a background. You might even say according to certain sets of laws, at least some such theorists might say so. But then, of course, in international relations, you have a whole bunch of interesting, important people that have been arguing for years now, decades, that we should be looking at international relations through analysis of kind of global social relations, so economic relations, cultural relations, various sorts of kind of social relations of a global kind. And to understand international relations, the relations between states, we need to understand these much broader, wider global social relations. They actually explain, in some senses, the patterns of interstate reactions. So what I'd like to do, I suppose, is push towards what you might call the relations beyond that. And I've kind of called them parasitic relations. But essentially relations of existence with things other than the humans. The humans themselves and human coordination problems, which is the core point of international relations as classically conceived, is not actually necessarily the core problem, the best way of framing what the problem of international relations is about. And this is what I must say, I've become quite convinced by some of these post-humanist arguments. If you actually look at international relations from the point of view, not where the viruses are equal with the humans, but you actually expose that human and the human coordination problems to the realities of the physical and material relationalities that we're in, you actually come to somewhat different sets of arguments about what matters in international relations. So I suppose what I'm trying to argue in the book, in essence, is a kind of expansion out of the ontology towards the kind of post-human sets of arguments. Personally, this is a completely new move, and it has provoked some interesting thoughts on things like democracy, for example. Democracy not as a human coordination problem, but democracy as an unfolding of relations with various sets of material sets of things, what Levi Bryant calls kind of terraformation. I think there's lots of interesting things that might come out of that. Whether or not they will, I don't quite know. I also, in the book, argue for this, you know, quite simple but flippant way. There are also certain sets of cosmological relations, besides the planetary parasitic relations that we're in, that we need to be mindful of, in quite simple senses, that there won't be any IR or any global social relations if we don't manage to also negotiate movements of the dust clouds in the Milky Way and such things. Those are far more difficult things for us to control, maybe. They might turn out to be easier to control than actually some of our social relations problems. Alas, we won't be here to think about those things unless we're also able to think about international relations, think about the global social relations in the context of even those kinds of sets of relations. So these are the kinds of moves I'm kind of playing with. On some level, I don't quite know what to make of them myself, except to say sometimes I feel they're kind of silly and stupid, because on some level, you sound like you're saying international relations should be doing everything in the cosmos, everything in the universe. What's the point of a social science that supposedly says it not only does all of global social relations, but it also does everything in the cosmos? I don't think that's quite the point. I think the point is to say the way in which we kind of develop conceptual apparatuses might have certain sets of monkey realisms in them. And if we actually go back to the findings of relational cosmology, of scientific cosmology, and think back that we've already found out that a lot of those assumptions are utterly wrong, and actually start to think again through different sets of assumptions, we might actually have somewhere else to go conceptually in trying to capture the world we're in. And it probably has, as some of the post-humanists argue, also something to do with our ability to actually survive on this planet, our capacities to conceptually think our way in a way that is less of the kind of the children of God and more of the coming messily from the mutley of bacteria eating each other. That probably has something to do with our ability to think about economies within the ecologies, democracies as part of the, you know, actual physical realities of things, rather than as somehow lifted out social things, lifted out from the rest of the things that we're in. I think fundamentally that's where relational cosmology takes you. Lee Smolin argues in his book that there's already a relational relational revolution already on its way for some decades, some hundred years. He's finding it's slow going in some fields. But certainly in art and also some social sciences and so on, there is a kind of a relational revolution on the way. I think the argument would be, and I think my argument is, that that relational revolution probably has to be even deeper and even further than it is, that it seems to us evident at the moment. Crazy thoughts, maybe, but let's see what you make of them. Let me leave it there. Thanks very much.
Many thanks for that mind-expanding, mind-bending talk. Why don't we take some questions and answers and maybe bundle up a few questions. Do you want to have a seat?
Yeah, I can do that.
Why don't we see if there's anyone in the audience who wants to raise a question? Any questions? Okay, so start with Bill.
Hi. Thanks for the presentation. I really enjoyed it. I think your work is very interesting, but I'll ask a pointed question. You sound like what post-structuralists were talking about 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And is this sort of, how do you, because that, yeah, I guess I'll just say that.
That's another question here.
Are you including any of Guattari's notion of ecosophies in the work? And how does that tie with the Donna Haraway's notions of the Anthropocene?
Do we have a third question to throw into the mix?
Yeah, thanks very much, Megan. Two-part question. Have you given up on scientific realism? Mm. It sounded like you
It's
had.
A very interesting question. I'm working my way through it.
This is my Colin White mode. The second question is, when you talked about monkey realism, one of the points about Newtonian physics is we live in a Newtonian world. That is to say, the effects of quantum mechanics operate at the very, very small subatomic level or at the cosmic level, but where we are, we still live in, planes fly, cars drive, people walk to the station using Newtonian principles of gravity and don't need anything else. So, I mean, how do you relate what you're doing to the kind of things that Alex Wendt does in his book? I mean, it seems to me he wants to argue that quantum effects do not decohere as soon as you get above the subatomic level and that we are walking wave functions and so on. Are you, do you have to buy that?
No.
To take your position?
Not for my position, no. And that goes into...
Yeah, we have two more questions. We can wait on those since there's a lot. We'll have a second round.
Do you mind if we just turn that thing off?
Yes.
Nasty, you might.
Why don't I do that while you're...
Right, great. Okay, lots of interesting questions. Let me start with the post-structuralism. Yeah, absolutely. Lots of people have written such things, similar things, not same things, partly because this is why I find puzzling, and to be honest, quite worrisome, certainly from my own thinking, but most of what I've written in the past has kind of tended to be somehow a critique of post-structuralism. And yet I think post-structuralists are onto something about the stretching move, the stretching away from things. The difference, though, in terms of coming to the science is there is a scientific realist kind of base to reading science, and the point here is not about language or discourse or our ways of talking about the world. It's actually based on kind of a particular scientific framework, but at the same time can be, if relational cosmology and all the ways of thinking about it are being proven wrong, then we're proven wrong, and it's the wrong way to go. And so, in that sense, there's a different grounding to thinking about things. It's not the same argument, if you like. Not entirely sure what the difference is when it comes then back to kind of thinking about the social systems and the IR aspect and so on. To what extent is my reading of kind of terraformation of democracy a different one from a post-structuralist reading of democracy as an ethos of democracy? I think there's a difference. I think there's a difference because it's a different set of arguments that take you there. I'm yet to work that out. That's the last section of the book, and it's the one that I didn't even properly get to during the sabbatical. But I suspect that there's a difference, and I think it matters, which is why I would like to hold on to the scientific realism, that we cannot reduce the cosmos and the universe to our language and linguistic plays around it. It's not possible, it's not reducible to it. So I'd like to hold on to the scientific realism. Whether I'm giving up on critical realism is a very interesting point, and I've written quite a lot of very detailed, and I think the ontology chapter now, it's about 20,000 words long, and it's too detailed and too philosophically intricate about really boring things, like how does relational cosmology speak to different forms of relational thinking? There are so many forms of different relational thinking in the social theory at the moment. How does this come to it? And I think one of the interesting things about relational cosmology is, in many ways, A, it explains the turn to relational thinking in social sciences, and at the same time, at least to me, it gives a slightly different way of navigating between different forms of relational thinking. For me, the upshot has been undoing certain aspects of critical realism. There's a very heavy metaphysics that goes with critical realism, and it's a kind of renunciation of the heavy metaphysic towards a critical realism that is kind of going post-human, much in the sense that I think Hobden and Cutworth and some of the complexity theorists have been developing also out of critical realism, but towards... Emergence is the key concept here, I think, because emergence for critical realists becomes the fundamental division line between social sciences and the natural sciences. And everything then once the humans have emerged, are an emergent set of properties, have emergent properties from the natural world becomes almost like a background to the movement of the humans in it. And social science becomes the critical realist social science, which is actually a kind of a humanist, Marxist, social science. Okay, you can read the Marxist in bracket, but I tend to think that that's how those arguments go. So one of the things I'm working on is exactly kind of a form of critical realism without the kind of a fixation on the emergence becoming a kind of argument for separation of the sciences from each other, which takes me to the point about Alex Wendt. I think I'm very much in line with Alex on the basic point that what we should be doing is doing more of social science that is actually dealing with the scientific claims. I think it's a hubris of the social sciences to think that we can do social science and not think about where the science is going. So I think we need to do exactly what Alex Wendt has done, and I think in part I'm trying to kind of do some of these things, not so well and so on. Whether that means that we have to buy into particular, he's particularly reading so quantum mechanics and so on, absolutely, absolutely not. And there's differences also. If you relational cosmology is essentially a kind of philosophical set of principles that arise out. It's what they call a natural philosophy, a rereading of science. Science and its philosophy, not a philosophy of science. So it's not looking at practices of scientists and then trying to philosophically explain why those happen, but rather a rereading of what it is that the consequences for our thinking of scientific findings kind of are. Out of it come particular sets of philosophical principles or concepts that we should use rather than other ones. And that's explicitly the relational cosmology argument. At the same time, is also a physical set of theories that can be testable, and it's at the heart of it is actually, in the physics side of it, at the heart of it is that we have to be able to test theories. That is exactly what is the problem with string theory and multiverse theories for the relational cosmologist. They're not testable theories. You can't test them. So you're literally reproducing a certain set of arguments that rely on the beauty of the maths and so on. We have no way of testing whether these theories are right or wrong. So actually there is a kind of a fundamental scientific realism here. It's just that it doesn't fit with my interpretation, at least, or my own understanding, at least my own version of critical realism. And so there's some movement there. That's a very long-winded answer. But yeah, thank you. Do we lean even new to when we will? Let me take that. I've got to take that. Hideyumi asked me exactly the same question not so long ago. And the key point of relational cosmology is to say, well, we live in a Newtonian world, if you think you live in a Newtonian world, but actually the whole point is to say it is not a Newtonian world. Newtonian world and the concepts that we have are particular approximations. All scientific theories, all ways of talking about the world, are approximations at something by monkeys about something. They're never fully capturing anything. And the key question here is, how should we try to approximate? The point of relational cosmologists is we're approximating with the wrong things, the wrong concepts, the concepts that are so rough that they actually lead us to misunderstand our predicament. And so if you understand people as some sort of things moving against backgrounds and societies on the basis of such idea, you're so misunderstanding, potentially, the realities of things that actually you're kind of back in a monkey realism. So the challenge they would give is basically, is it useful to think outside of the Newtonian box? They would say yes, because it gives us a different way of thinking, a different way of approximating, and they would say, both scientifically and social scientifically, a better, more closely capturing, without capturing, kind of approximation at the world. So it's a tricky one. And, I'm sure we can all agree, if we live in a Newtonian universe and we want to stay on living in it, then let's live in it. But also it kind of doesn't necessarily help us very much, which is, I think, also there is a kind of a normative drive in some of this relational cosmology to kind of say, that's exactly our problem, is that we, in a sense, think that we are in this thing, which is a particular approximation of things, by a particular theological guy that really believed in God and really wanted to maintain a particular set of theological beliefs about God and his role in the universe and so on. But why on earth would we be wedded to those ways of thinking now? when we know, A, that it's not bad approximation, but also when we know that the social and political consequences of that way of thinking are not necessarily very positive. So I think, yeah, it's a difficult, difficult question. On Guattari and so on, yes, I use some things, but not directly. It doesn't come from Guattari. I don't come at it from the Guattari. I come from these guys, and explicitly from these guys. And especially that chapter 5 is a kind of it's a negotiation through and in between some other forms of relational thinking that absolutely are on similar lines, but I'm trying to kind of extrapolate out some of the things that these guys have put forward. So yes, I make reference also to Haraway and so on, but it's not an effort to try to, at least so far it hasn't been, maybe it has to be. it hasn't at least so far been an effort to do a Guattarian kind of thing. But it's not irrelevant, partly because Guattari and all those guys are, I would suspect, part of a kind of a relational revolution, I think, and it's just not necessarily the same kind of relationality, but that's not a bad thing. It's still better to think in relational terms, even if you think in different relational terms, I would think, than to think in terms of just things, backgrounds and laws, and I think there all the relationalists would probably agree with each other. But thank you, yeah.
I have Sarah in the back, and then Matthias. Was there a third question floating somewhere? Okay, great. Okay, so Sarah first.
This is just a very good question about outstanding. It's the first time I've come across ecology stuff. Could you clarify again how outstanding
question is actually very similar in Sarah's, and also this question about the Newtonian world. During your talk, I wasn't sure whether you were essentially saying that the relational cosmological term would help us to provide better answers to the problems, the questions that IR scholars are now asking, or whether they're supposed to direct us towards questions that we are not asking. Okay?
Yeah.
So from your answer to Chris's question, I gather that you're saying both. Okay.
Yeah.
So then my question becomes, but would like you to confirm whether this is the case. Are we asking the right question when you're talking about, war and peace and development and governing, climate change sort of things, or are we sort of parochial in a sense in our concerns? But then if the question is this is promising to go beyond Newtonianism to provide answers to those questions, can you give us some example? And this is where basically my question is the same as Sarah. Can you a little bit more concrete how this relational perspective, cosmopolitan relational perspective, would illuminate things that otherwise we wouldn't see?
We have one more question.
I come from the anthropology department at the University College, and so I'm quite familiar with their work. Bruno Latour was written in a quite different way about international relations and cosmology, in particular, arguing that even if we look at entities as well as relations between entities, the entities that write international relations are people with different cosmology. So in a quite different way, there is a different way, therefore, in which we can think about international relationships in a multi-cosmological way. And I just wondered whether there could be any connection between the fact that some of the alterity in the world we have to accord to other cosmologies as well as our own. Whether there could be any connection, maybe analytically, between that kind of approach and your own.
Yeah, very interesting. And I'm not sure. I have to do a lot more. I have been reading a fair bit of Latour and trying to get my head around all that. And I've either been using Latour in some of my more empirical things, just because they're actually very helpful ways of looking at the world. There's a disagreement between myself and Latour just on kind of some of the social theoretical things, because the flattening out and the removal of the notion of abstraction is, I think, exactly the wrong move, because abstraction is exactly what you need if you need to stretch out and away from the knowledge, the situated knowledge and so on. So you can't flatten things to the touchy-feely relations that you feel in the world. You have to do the kind of thing that critical realists and others have been calling for, that abstraction thing. It's just that without the emergence thing, so hence how it gets completed. But that is a very interesting question. I don't know how to come at it, to be honest. I don't have any good answers to it, except to kind of say the whole of relational cosmology in many ways is a critique of a particular Western theological common sense secularism and its influence on physics, and then its influence on social and political theory. What its implications are for thinking about other kinds of cosmologies, socially inherited as well as perhaps scientific, outside of that, is a little bit unclear to me. In many ways, it kind of ties in with some of the, I mean, I often get asked about indigenous cosmologies and so on. That is there a sympathy there? I think there is, in the sense of the relationality, the kind of emphasis on relationality and so on. That said, there's a very different grounds for those things. And certainly in relational cosmology, and certainly in my own thinking so far, there I have done nothing really, and I should to think through the kind of the problems of the kind of Western centrism of the entire shebang of relational cosmology, and what that means. It goes back to Will Bain's questions about kind of relationality as is framed here, and perhaps, and some theological origins of Christianity and so on. But yeah, that's a poor answer, but I'll have to think about it more, and I shall read more moral tour as well. On the other set of questions, you're very, very helpful way of actually putting it. It just goes to show why you present and don't sit in your room and just do this on your own. Just phrasings are helpful. That whole phrasing about, is it that the questions are wrong, or is it that relational cosmology is helping us to answer? Actually, the questions are right, but is it helping us answer those questions? And I think it is both, actually. And I haven't actually quite phrased it like that, nor have I really thought through what the implications of that are. The other problem I have here is that, for me at least, the questions about the practicalities and the kind of what's the empirical output of this way of thinking, is that it's so far removed from where I am at the moment with it still, that I feel very silly talking about such things. But one of the interesting things for me, and I'm sure lots of you that know democracy, literature and so on better than I do, but I've done some fair bits of things on democracy and so on. One of the really interesting things, even when you think about democracy promotion and so on, is just to think back to just how human-centric, humanist is the entirety of the democracy, kind of a lot of democracy literature. And there I have read a little Latour and so on, democracy and thinking outside of things. But out of this perspective also comes a very different way of thinking about, I think, for me, and what makes a democratization succeed. And so, because it's a democratization that is kind of closer to the kind of new materialist kind of thinking about the direct relations between us as related things in our context and the success of these human coordination institutions like democracy. So democracy doesn't succeed on the basis of whether we have the right kind of institutional systems for management of individuals. It doesn't even rely on the social democratic arguments about whether we have the right redistributive system, even though there is a different way of coming at that question from that. But it also relies fundamentally, actually, on parameters of kind of the ecologies, or parameters of the way in which we physically are embodied in those institutions. And so, at least for me, I mean, they are new lines of thinking, and they have come from the relational cosmology. Are they new? Not really. And this is the thing that puzzles me about this thing. I mean, it literally emerged as a kind of a 5%. I called it my 5% book for a long time, because it's I only had 5% of my time to put into it, because I had to do impact and democracy promotion and, you know, policy things and that sort of thing. And I just, to be honest, became quite disillusioned with all that. And I'm just lucky to have not gotten a grant in the summer. So my sabbatical was actually spent on this. Whether it's new and so on, I don't think any of these arguments are new. They're just kind of one way of weaving together, if you like, into kind of a grand narrative of a kind, different things from different sciences to get a clearer sense of what is going on with some of this relationality thinking, what's going on with IR theory, why is it that we have complexity theories and new materialism and so on rising at the moment, rightly, I think, not just because, okay, Jonathan Joseph and others would say it's because of capitalism and new materialism and a form of neoliberal thinking and so on. I don't think it is actually the case. I think we are onto something as humans on this planet and in the social sciences by going in that direction. This gives kind of an explanation of why that's the right way to go, not just in the Marxist sense to say social relations is what matters, is because that's how human relations are kind of based. No, actually, because we know a hell of a lot more also about the world and the universe and biology and our ecologies and so on to go that way. And so I don't know what it is, quite this book, but it has IR implications, I think, because it strengthens the case of those IR theories, in a sense. It kind of backs up some of the cases of complexity theory, some forms of new materialism and so on, in a different kind of way. Plus, at least for me, one day, the next book or something, I will work on this democracy stuff, democratization. I'll propose it to the European Commission and then do impact for them on that basis. No, I don't think so. But yeah, lots of interesting questions. I'm waffling now. Oh, how does the relational perspective concretely give you a different perspective? Was it, as I just said, I don't quite know. And certainly one thing I know is that it's not a social theory that we kind of apply to the world. That I know, because A, it's not a social theory. It's a natural philosophy. Which has implications for our conceptual systems for devising theoretical ways of coming at things. But it's certainly not a social theory. It's one thing it isn't. But it is a philosophical orientation that comes from an interdisciplinary engagement of social theory, philosophy, and physics. That's what it is. I don't know what that is and whether it's any good or whatever, but I have this feeling that it says something to a number of things, number of people, number of literatures in number of areas. That is actually interesting. Where it goes, I don't know, but I need to work on that more. Concrete, empirical examples. I know it's always a challenge. Always a challenge for me, certainly when I go into the disappear into the philosophy side of things. But thank you very much. Lots of things to think about. Are there any?
Any more questions?
Maybe could you rephrase? Sorry.
So kind of a Newtonian way of looking at international relations. We have variables dependent and independent variables and things moving. You're saying we should move away from it, but I was just asking whether or not that stuff has a role to play, even if we do adopt a relational cosmology way.
Can I ask separate but perhaps related question, and that is, if, as you've acknowledged and alluded to in part in response to the question, but also in your presentation, there's already a whole realm of social science that is relational, then by bringing in forms of relationality that are cosmological, can you identify from your readings and your explorations in astrophysics and otherwise, are there forms of relationality, are there relations that we can observe and that scientists have observed out there, if not, you know, that are understood only with that appreciation of the universe, that are in some ways suggestive of new kinds of relationality in international relations that are different and are illuminating in some way. So the most obvious example that we used to refer to, remember those of you who were alive during the Cold War, people used to say about Soviet satellites, right? The satellite states. I mean, are there, so if notions of orbit, galaxies, so are there ways in which there are observable kinds of relations that those who study the cosmos have revealed that we can then bring home to Mother Earth in more concrete, you know, if only metaphorical ways that are different from the kinds of relationality that, you know, the social sciences produces one way or another, self-consciously or otherwise.
Just in the last one, you know, one crucial way, of course, I mean, in the cosmos, at least so far, we haven't found any forms of life. And life is a particular kind of self-organizing form of reproducing energy flows. And we know that we haven't found those kinds of things. We haven't found societies of aliens or whatever, and we don't know how those kinds of things turn out. But we want, and in that sense, because, you know, there is such a thing as emergence, right? Stars are not the same things as human beings, and so societies are not the same things as stars. There are different kinds of relationalities and different kinds of processes involved in those things. Yet, if you think about stars, I mean, stars are self-organizing systems of flow of energy and matter in exactly the same way that life is also a self-organizing flow of energy and matter, and every single being in this room still relies on the solar energy ultimately to move your bodies, to do anything, even thinking. You're absolutely reliant on that particular solar formula. So there's certain kinds of similarities, certainly in forms of flow of energy, matter, and so on, but the levels of complexity and the ways in which they move are different, and the kinds of relations that we have are also different, which is why you can't say that social relations are kind of analogous, how do you say?
Analogous.
Yeah, to stars. It's different kinds of things, and emergence there, you know, it's true. The human brain and da-da-da-da and the societal formations and so on, they are different. So the point is not, in a sense, to say, here's stars, they're like this, and here's analogy for how we use that in social sciences. But it is to say that if you understand that a star is a self-regulating flow of matter and energy, then in exactly the same way, actually, we can see that biology of all of us and all the things, and even social systems in some senses, are tied up with those energy flows. If our societies were incapable of flowing energy and matter in ways that maintain us physically, there wouldn't be a society or social sciences to think about. So societies are, in a Guattari way, if you like, you know, tied up with these things. I'm not sure it's helpful necessarily to draw the direct analogies. I'm not sure it's helpful, but it doesn't mean that we can't learn in our language and our philosophy about the world from how it is that we actually know about how stars form and how every single element in you and this and that was created there. And we didn't know anything about that when most of our social and conceptual systems in social sciences were created. And that's kind of weird. It's very weird that we're working on conceptual bases that go back to times when we just didn't know the basic things. And now we know some of those things. And in 100 years' time, we'll think that we were really monkeys now, because we'll probably know something else and something more, and we'll probably think in hopefully in different kinds of ways. But this is relational cosmologist's problem. How long it takes for these legacies of the Greeks and the theologists and so on to work through social systems. That's, in a sense, puzzling for them. They're not saying, let's think like the physicists. They're saying, physicists must think more like social scientists or social historians, and social scientists need to think a little bit more about the physics and how that underpins conceptual frameworks that we work with. And that's all it is. And that's, I think, what Alex Wendt is doing. It's kind of a dialogue about how do monkeys like us in the social sciences, in the natural sciences, think about the world. Sorry, I'm going on. Again. Sorry, did you want to come in on that? Because I was just... No. The question about Newtonian ways of thinking, variables, causes, and so on. They're very prevalent, and we were kind of talking about that at lunch, actually. You know, if you think about the EU's log frame for dealing with development aid and so on, you know, there's a very mechanistic way of looking at the world. There's a lovely book by Mike Foley, one of the people on American politics, lovely book about laws, men and machines, the mechanistic conception of democracy in American political system, how that is influenced and structured by mechanistic thinking that goes back to thermodynamic laws and so on. Yes. Do they have, your questions, do they still have a role to play? Well, probably. Not only because they're kind of useful for certain kinds of things, but when we have societies based on the conceptual systems on which they are based, they are particularly useful. So they are reproduced, as any conceptual systems tend to be, also within the societies that we live in. So they are probably going to be, and it's not to say also that they're not useful, they're useful, but here's my classical critical theorist kind of coming out. All kinds of ways of knowing about the world are useful, but often they tend to be useful for particular kinds of things, and particular kind of effects flow from those ways of knowing. So let's kind of think about it. I'm not saying that we should never think in Newtonian terms. I don't think the relational cosmologists are saying, let's scrap Newton and kick him out. No, I mean, Newton is part of the way in which we deal with the physical world, and quite simply, ISS and all these guys, some of it is to do with quantum mechanical effects and so on, relativity effects and so on, but most of it is actually just Newtonian physics. You can still send a guy to Mars pretty much on Newtonian physics, so it's not like you should throw it out. That's not the point. The point are there better approximations? That's the question. And their claim is, there are better approximations because we already have them and we already need them to exist as we do. We know they are more right than the Newtonian approximation, but that doesn't mean that the Newtonian approximation was wrong, it was just rough. So we can have other kinds of approximations, and that helps us. That's how science advances. That's how presumably also social science advances in a dynamic world where social relations also evolve. So it's, I don't know if that's a good answer, but sorry.
Since we've run out of time, let me just close with a plug, not for subsequent talks in the Department of International Relations, but a sort of odd related plug that I mentioned earlier to Milia, which is that there's an amazing exhibit at the Natural History Museum called Other Worlds, incredible photographs cobbled together from NASA imagery. So if you ever want to know what it looks like to see the sunset from Mars, go there, and with Brian Eno music in the background, you can have an amazing experience. But in the meantime, let's thank Milia properly for a really interesting, stimulating talk, and I'm sure we all look forward to reading the book. So many thanks for sharing.